entire neighborhood of distinctive front yard junk art created by Patrick Umio, Bridget Laurent, and their Big Times Art Studio. Florence Avenue, where the artists happen to live, is ablaze with colorful junk tucked in with the roses and trees. Half the fun in this pop rivet wonderland is noticing how it's done. One character boasts a repurposed flashlight for a nose, another a double coat hook or bed frame casters. Engaging eccentrics rise up from nearly every yard up and down the street, including the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz, riding her Hoover vacuum to go get Dorothy.
"I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too."
And sympathetic but comical superheroes. Here, Superman's sidekick is an actual Robin, tiny supersuit and all. Among the birds, the crowbar usually gets the biggest laugh. Squiffed corvids in fine feather, beak to bar, or bar stool. And believable if you've ever seen robins tumble stupidly out of pyracantha, pie-eyed from overripe berries. Still waiting for your prince? Florence Avenue's frog prince steps right out of the fairy tale, complete with a crown made from a turban-style roof vent and emergency flasher eyes. He offers royal bling, too, a sapphire ring big as a baseball. Tempted? As Chet Atkins and Ray Stevens say,
"If you've never been a frog kissing, then you don't know what you've been missing yet. There's a world of opportunity under each and every log."
Everyone loves the cycling, surfing, and tractor-driving dogs. The happy hog, manning the Three Little Pigs construction truck. Godzilla carrying off a distraught driver. All the baseball players, including the Babe. Even hockey stars. Timely social commentary, too. What with Ukraine delivering a literal body blow to Russia. Until next time, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia.
Feathers, fur, or fins. Feathers, fur, or fins. If it walks on legs or flies on wings, if it runs or crawls or slithers or swims, it's got its place in the scheme of things. Feathers, fur, or fins. Feathers, fur, or fins. Shell or skin or scale, they're Mother Nature's marvels, from the ant up to the whale. And if we ever lose them, they won't be back again. So let's all take good care of every feather, fur, or fin. Feathers, fur, or fins. Feathers, fur, or fins. If it walks on legs or flies on wings, if it runs or crawls or slithers or swims, it's got its place in scheme of things. Feathers, fur, or fins. Feathers, fur, or fins.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and this is a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. This evening we'll be talking with Peter Galvin. He's co-founder and director of programs of the Center for Biological Diversity, an organization that does fabulous, wide-ranging environmental work throughout the world. Before working for the center, Peter worked as a contract wildlife researcher for the U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Arizona Game and Fish Department.
A longtime environmental activist, Peter also serves on the board of directors of the Beech Hill Foundation and is a member of the science oversight team for the Global OWL Project. He'll be talking about the priorities for 2023 of the Center for Biological Diversity.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Halo MRI Center, offering comprehensive MRI services for scheduling, efficient turnaround times, and exceptional customer care. Halo MRI Center's state-of-the-art facilities and dedicated staff who provide an exceptional health care experience without facility fees, smaller deductibles, or copays. For more information, visit Halo MRI Center, that's HALOMRICenter.com, or 530-898-0500 to schedule your appointment. And we're made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Butte County Local Food Network, dedicated to creating a more healthy, just, resilient, and regenerative local food system. The Butte County Local Food Network is looking for volunteers to help with this year's Garden Blitz in March, especially those with trucks. To help, visit BCLOCalFood.org for details and information. Be part of the solution. We want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll be back in just a moment to talk with Peter Galvin. This is Ecotopia on 90.1 KZFR.
It's not Earth that's in trouble, it's the people that live on it. No, no, Earth will be here long after we've all gone the way of the dodo. It's not Earth that's in trouble, it's the people that live on it. No, no, Earth will be here long after we've all gone the way of the dodo.
Imagine the day when things have actually faded away, but the day I may not be able to pay my way could be today. It's not that I don't care, just that I'm way too caught up breathing air to grieve for the trees and air, or how breathable air is. You go first, I follow suit. Make your mistakes, I'll copy, mate. I'm right behind you, but don't expect me to ride like it's a race, cause you'll be back there picking scraps while I miss the mug. Dude, put it round and I've lost my rank and place. I've got to manage my little space.
It's not Earth that's in trouble, it's the people that live on it. No, no, Earth will be here long after we've all gone the way of the dodo. It's not Earth that's in trouble, it's the people that live on it. No, no, Earth will be here long after we've all gone.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and our guest this evening is Peter Galvin. He's co-founder and director of programs of the Center for Biological Diversity, an organization that does fabulous, wide-ranging environmental work throughout the world. He's a longtime environmental activist. He also serves on the board of directors of the Beech Hill Foundation and is a member of the science oversight team for the Global OWL Project.
Before we get started, I want to let our listeners know that the Center for Biological Diversity has joined in a CEQA lawsuit with the Sierra Club and Aqua Alliance here in Chico against the proposed Valley's Edge Development Project. If you are a regular listener of our program, you know that Smart Growth Advocates and Save Our Hometown have just submitted over 8,000 signatures of 5,700 required for a referendum to let voters determine if we want that urban sprawl project. So I want to begin by welcoming Peter Galvin and thank him and the Center for Biological Diversity for their efforts on the part of our communities. Welcome, Peter. Thank you. Can you hear me? Peter, can you hear me? I totally messed up.
Hi.
There we go.
Did you hear our introduction even?
I did. Can you, am I coming across okay?
You're coming across perfectly. Okay. Yeah. I just missed.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind words.
Yeah, thank you.
We'd like to talk about the Center for Biological Diversity's priorities for 2023. But tell us about the founding of the organization. It's a great story.
Well, thank you. In 1989, the center was formed, and there were a group of four of us primarily, and a couple of us had been working for the Forest Service doing spotted owl surveys in the Gila National Forest in New Mexico. And through that process, and various of us had had different experience in environmental activism previous to that. I had lived in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon in the early 80s and when the old growth forest battles were really beginning there. And so I had witnessed that and participated in it, and that really had changed my life profoundly. Eventually went back to college, got a job with the Forest Service as an assistant biologist looking for spotted owls, goshawks, and bald eagles. And through that process became more keenly aware of sort of how the process worked of lands management and wildlife management. And it was very distressing to find out that all of the work that we were doing to help locate endangered species was not, well, at that time they weren't endangered species, I would say imperiled species, wasn't well received by the Forest Service. Our immediate boss, the wildlife biologist, he was very supportive, but the people that he worked with in the other divisions of the Forest Service were really not supportive, and in some cases actively hostile. And so it was through that experience that three of us and then our an emergency room doctor in Phoenix, Arizona, Dr. Robin Silver, started the predecessor group to the center, which eventually became the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity, which then eventually became the Center for Biological Diversity. And so it was, a formative period in our mid-20s for three of us, and Dr. Silver was a little older, but it was really a great times were had, and we had the support of a lot of people, a small community of environmental activists in the Southwest really helped us get going, and so and all of those people are still with the center today, and we're still good friends and enjoy each other's company and love the work that we do.
I love that. We interviewed Tiara Curry a few weeks ago about her work for the center, and in looking for her, we discovered the astounding number of staff people who are a part of the center. Can you describe the breadth and depth of the work the center does? I mean, it's all over. You're everywhere.
I know.
It's amazing.
You don't have enough to... Yeah, thank you.
I know.
You
we don't have enough time.
We have no. to go to the Jerry Lewis telethon mode for that. But there's 170 staff, including 45 lawyers, and it's a mix. The center is a mix of activism, law, science, creative media. There are a lot of groups that do each of those things, but very few, if any, I'm not aware of, that combine all of those things and feel comfortable with the panoply of from protests to direct action, civil disobedience to litigation, to lobbying, to making TikTok and YouTube videos and trying to have a creative bent to many of the projects. And so it's 170 of the most dedicated people that you can imagine, just wonderful people. We have attorneys who've been lawyers for 30 or 40 years, some that are just out of law school. We have, Tiara, of course, is very amazing. And we have just, some of the best scientists, some of the best. We have several self-trained naturalists that are just top-notch. So it's a mix of disciplines. And it's an incredible team of people that I'm, you know, honored to be able to work with every day. And the breath is thanks. The breath is wide ranging. You know, we have programs relating to population and sustainability, carnivore conservation, a climate law institute, an endangered species program, an energy justice program, an environmental health program, international issues, oceans, I mentioned population and sustainability, public lands, and urban wildlands, the program which brought the case there over the Stonegate development there. And so it's you know, it really is wide ranging on any given day. Just today alone, if you look at our website, we issued 5 press releases just today on different issues that the center took action on, you know, ranging from, there was good news that the Mexican gray wolf, a species we've been working on for decades, its population grew by 23% last year, and so we celebrated that. It's still, there's still only 241 individuals, so it's still in tough shape, but that's great news. You know, for years it was either declining or holding steady. We issued a press release today that the state of Florida is considering using radioactive phosphogypsum for road construction. It's just it's insane. Phosphogypsum is mined for fertilizer, and Florida is where a lot of this stuff occurs. And what's left after the useful stuff is taken, it are these waste stacks that where the naturally occurring radioactivity is concentrated, this stuff, there's the highest points in Florida outside of the panhandle are these leftover phosphogypsum stacks from phosphogypsum mining. And it's just, you know, there's whole parts of the state that are just a hellscape from this, and they want to keep doing more of it, so they're trying to figure out what to do with this stuff. And so they've come up with this idea to use it in road building. They could just encase it in the road, which seems like just a terrible idea. And as more people find out about it, they're not, you know, not happy to learn that, that radioactive material, it is naturally occurring, I would say, but in a concentrated form. So it's more radioactive than it would be in nature, right? Because it's all been concentrated together. So it's just, you know, it can't be good. We filed, we took out an ad in the New York Times today with, dealing with electric, the administration's lack of making an adequate transition on electric cars. They've made a lot of noise and have done a few things, but not enough. We issued a press release. The state of Florida has enacted some rules to protect diamondback terrapins from recreational crab traps. And that was exciting. So that was just today.
Wow.
And you know, so it's never a dull moment, and there's a lot of you know, a lot of ins and outs, a lot of variables, a lot of stuff to deal with, and a great team of people doing the work. We have, you know, folks that, you know, it ranges from big, you know, big issues to small issues. We're sending people to the Convention on Biological Diversity, to the Climate Summit. But we're also, you know, dealing with all creatures, great and small, vernal pools, you know, invertebrates, plants, we're interested in it all.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could describe, we're getting a good sense of how you work, but maybe one of your notable successes that demonstrates how all of these components come together, the law, activism, medicine, publicity, media releases, and so forth.
A notable success or two.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, one that just came out is we've been trying to get the California spotted owl, which occurs over by you folks, on the endangered species list for 23 years. And it's taken a couple formal petitions. You know, we're not talking, not the kind of like on change.org. These are petitions that are like 80 pages long with references and footnotes and then several lawsuits, and an enormous amount of pressure was applied by the timber industry. But finally, The California spotted owl is now proposed to be added as an endangered species to the endangered species list, which should help protect the remaining large trees on public lands and be a important bulwark against some of these logging, the renewal of large scale logging on national forests in California that's now coming back. So that was one that is been an exciting. An exciting thing. And then let's see. Well, you know, there's so many. Well, we had a, I can't even pronounce the name of the pesticide. It's so, it's so complex.
Multisyllabic.
Let me find it. But there's a pesticide that we recently got banned by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the EPA's approval of the pesticide was illegal, and I'm going to, while we're talking, I'm going to find the name. It's incomprehensible, but that's that was an exciting one. So there, you know, there's been a lot of victories. It's like a lot of things. You can't you can't win if you don't play, and we have a lot of irons in the fire. So there are some great victories, some crushing defeats. But, you know, we soldier on.
Mm-hmm. I want to share a spotted owl story. It was about 20 years ago. I was up in Quincy, California. I was on a bike ride, and we camped overnight at the fairgrounds. They were having a big do. There was a parade. And as part of the parade, a huge logging truck came by. On it was riding Miss Quincy, a charming high school age girl. And she had a big sign that said, "Wipe your bottom on a spotted owl."
Oh my God!
Wow! Yeah,
yes.
I remember
so much hostility.
When I first moved to California, there was instead of hamburger helper, there was a store that had a box of the spotted owl helper. I thought that was slightly clever, but in poor taste.
Yeah.
But you know, people are free to express themselves as they wish, and we wouldn't have it any other way, but we disagree and continue on with our programs.
So what do you attribute this center's success? I mean, I think you're right. We've done a lot of interviews with a lot of environmental organizations, and I think the center is unique. How was it, the vision, or how did it get this big and complex? And Peter?
Good question. It's the people, really. We invest a lot in our people. They're not replaceable in large part. They're unique, and we work around the strengths of those individuals to find what it is that's going to get the best out of them for the environment. So, we're long before the pandemic, we were flexible about, people like, we'd have really, really good top quality people that would, they're raising a kid and they say, I can't work in the office every day. I need to work at home 3 days a week. And we'd be like, that's fine. Now that flexibility, a lot of employers have provided that flexibility, but we've been doing it for 30 years.
Yeah.
And then you'd have people that maybe, we had one guy, a real celebrated environmental lawyer from down in Santa Barbara. His wife got a job as a professor in Chicago, and the group that he was working with, was a regionally based group. So, that isn't going to work for you to work from Chicago. And we found out that he was, going to be looking for work, and that was going to work fine for us. And, he's just the most incredible guy, who's this absolutely brilliant person. I'm sure he could, in private practice be making just millions. But that isn't what he wants. He wants to work with us. And, so that flexibility, investing in people, we have probably 40 people going to the premier environmental law conference in the world in Eugene, Oregon, coming up at the end of this week, and a lot of people want to go, and we want them to go. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, so it's a good life-work balance. Now that's a big buzzword, but before it wasn't. And, you know, the reality is finding people who, I mean, these, we pay them, but the reality is they would pay us to do this work if they could and they had to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, those are the people
mm-hmm.
you want,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
This isn't,
right.
It's not a job, it's a mission.
Mm-hmm.
They all have needs and those needs have to be met. But, and so it's a, and there's a, we have, you know, we like to have fun.
Right,
these people,
right, right.
They like, and we like to send them out into the field. Like, you could just be staring at a computer screen, you know, and writing letters and comments, but they'll go out with the world's expert on the freshwater mollusks, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Tierra spends a couple days a year joining the surveys. And I think that's really meaningful to her. And that's great because you're going to know more about the issue and you're making connections and relationships with the people who are the world expert. And so these are, you know, just, so I would say finding, you know, and we're lucky because the mission is to protect endangered species and wild places and the environment, the types of people who apply are, you know, are already,
sure.
already
yeah.
pretty mission-oriented to begin with. In large part, and then you know, sifting through, and it's tough because we have, you know, more people who are absolutely qualified that applied than we can possibly hire, but we try and you know, and there's ones that we didn't hire that I wish we had, but it's you know, investing in the people, realizing that each of these people, you know, they want to succeed and they want to be a leader in their field. And there's enough space to do that. I think a lot of organizations, it's almost like there's only enough credit. There's not enough credit to go around, and or only a certain number of people can be decision makers. But that isn't right, because in any organization, you have to have, the people have to have autonomy
mm-hmm.
to implement the vision. And you can't, there's no way you can micromanage
right.
170 people 24 hours a day. You have to, you know, as people earn the stripes, you have to give them the latitude to implement the vision, and then if they get into a pickle, to back them up.
Right. I want to work for
so,
you.
yeah.
We'll ask at the end of the show how people can support the center, but I wonder if you could give us a, and what's your budget like, and what are your major sources of support?
Well, the budget is about $22 million a year.
Sorry.
And the, yeah, the support is largely from members. We have 57,000 dues-paying members, and then 1.7 million people who are on the email list who have not, they have not yet been donors, or they were donors and now they're just on the email list, but perhaps they'll become donors again. Of the 57,000, there are a couple thousand that give $1,000 a year or more.
Wow.
Which we call our leadership circle. And then there are a handful of individuals that give several hundred thousand dollars a year. And then there are foundations provide
okay.
About 30% of the budget. And one of the things we pride ourselves on is that a lot of groups, a lot of larger groups get a higher percentage of the money from foundations than we do. And that's great. You know, foundations are great, but they can be fickle. They can change their,
mm-hmm.
Their, you know, one, you know, somebody takes over, or maybe the kids take over and they decide to change the focus from whatever it was to something else.
Right.
And so, you know, it's important not to get too dependent on the foundations, because they're, you know, they like to mix it up. They don't want to just keep supporting the same people year
yeah,
after year.
Right.
They like to have new and exciting things too. So the membership is the key, and cultivating those members and really being having good customer service, basically, to you know, to put it in a very sort of basic terms,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, we send people you know handwritten notes to thank them for their donation, and we don't have a lot of swag to send people, so people are, I think, are happy that you can get a t-shirt or a hat if you want, but we don't, you know, we don't have the stuffed polar bears and plush toys and stuff like that that I think our members probably wouldn't want that stuff anyway, and would probably wonder, like, why are you making this crap? Yeah, why are you
They're just going to go into the landfill.
Right. So the membership, you know, we've had people with us from the very beginning. We have a handful of members who've been of the original members from 1989, and then we have some corporations that support us. Different green companies. Patagonia has been a big supporter over the years. REI has given us some support.
Nice.
And different the Cliff Bar people. You know, the list goes.
Yeah.
Goes on, but it's a lot of outdoor recreation businesses have supported us, and then the lawyers. If the lawyers win, if you sue the government and win, the legal fees aren't always, but can be paid. So the lawyers help with that too.
Nice.
So, in your winter newsletter, Peter Galvin, the Center for Biological Diversity set out 5 priorities for 2023. We're going to list them here, go into some depth, although we won't be able to go into enough depth on all of them. But the 5 priorities are: declare national emergencies over the climate crisis and the loss of wildlife. 2, double the amount of protected land and water. 3, defend and fully fund the Endangered Species Act. 4, protect endangered species from dangerous pesticides. And 5, act boldly to protect wildlife. So what's the import of number 1, declare a national emergency over the climate crisis and the loss of wildlife? Isn't that something that's already been done by other organizations? How will your approach differ?
Well, it hasn't been done. I think Trump was really, instructive. In he took office, he declared an emergency along the border, began building his ridiculous and ineffective wall. Mm-hmm. But the point was well taken, which is, he's going to declare a national emergency, and in doing so, all the laws, basically, the president has enormous power to implement things through executive action, and especially when a national emergency is declared. And so, I mean, if the climate crisis doesn't qualify as a national emergency, I don't know what does. If the loss of our brothers and sisters in the wildlife world isn't a national emergency, I'm not sure what is. And so Biden had, during his campaign, absolutely commit, but strongly suggested that he would in fact declare a climate national emergency. And has not yet done so. He passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which had a lot of climate fighting things in it, which is good. But really, that's just a small down payment on the promises that he made, and a couple of which he has not stuck to, which is very concerning. But in order to fully marshal the powers of the federal government, the climate emergency declaration allows the president to take dramatic action. And right now the Supreme Court is just gunning down his initiatives one by one.
Right.
And they're just, it's like a cat. It's like a cat with a mouse, and it's not faring well. And we see, today is the student loan thing.
Right.
We got the pro-choice. They already struck down various climate regulations, and so he doesn't want to alter the composition of the Supreme Court. Well, the only other tool available to him is to declare the national emergency. Mm-hmm. And time is time is short. A president doesn't have that long, before they need to start, figuring out either running for re-election or finding the next person who's going to. The point is that the window is short. And for all the terrible things Trump did, you can look at him and say, he knew that the time, that the hourglass was running out, and they were paying close attention to the hourglass. And Biden is not paying as close attention to the hourglass, and it's unacceptable. We have to get him to keep the commitments that he made. If he wants to receive, you know, if he wants people to be pumped up about his accomplishments and successes, he's got to pull all the levers that are available to him. And right now he's not.
So how do you get him to do that? What's the plan?
Yeah. Well, there's two plans. One is to continue the pressure, and two is as more and more of his agenda is undercut by the Supreme Court and the despondency of his support base is increased. It's probable they're going to knock out the student loan thing, which of course doesn't have directly anything to do with the climate thing. But my larger point is, as different parts of his agenda are dismantled by this, right-wing court that was packed, he's going to have to look for the actions that are available to him, and this is one of the big ones. And so it may be that in order to maintain progress on his agenda, he becomes aware that it is absolute, there's no other option. I think it appears as if he would hope that sound minds could prevail and he could cajole or in some partnership manner get these things implemented. But it's pretty clear that the forces arrayed against progress are not, not reasonable people ready to make a bipartisan accord. And so, we're keeping the pressure on. We're, taking all the actions that we can through public organizing. We have we're following him around and trying to get wherever he goes people to have signs and to raise a hue and a cry. We're lobbying, we're doing a lot of press work, but let's face it, the first couple of years of any president's term are it's difficult to break through the din and roar, and there's a certain halo. And that over time, people start to say, all right, you've been there for a while. We like, you've done some good stuff, but where's the, where's the main course? And then the main course keeps getting recalled, back to the kitchen by the right wing. And so it's, I guess the long and short of it is we're not exactly sure how we're going to accomplish that, but we're trying a variety of things to do that. And it may be that his own frustration at having his, even his modest agenda stymied at every turn, finally has him, living up to his original pledge, which was all but said that he would declare a climate emergency.
Right. So lobbying him, writing to him, getting people around him, getting the attention of the people around him, advisors and so forth. I have a campaign. I'm going to move on to the second one because I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. But it's the second one is to double the amount of protected land and water. And I feel like your lawsuits with Stonegate and Valley's Edge are both to that end, that we're trying to protect that land to keep it from development, and that would, be a part of what you're doing there. Does that mainly involve lawsuits, or?
Well, right now there's an initiative that's a global initiative, big worldwide initiative that the U.S. is involved in, and it's called the 30 by 30,
right?
And 50 by 50, and it was first advanced by an eminent scientist who I think he passed away recently, E.O. Wilson,
right?
Who came up with this idea of half Earth, and actually wrote a book. Yes, he did pass away in late 2021,
right?
Half Earth. And the idea was that, in order for humanity to continue to live the life that we're living now, that basically we depend on wild nature, we depend on the health of nature. It's not just an amenity, not just a scenic thing, but we actually depend on it for everything from the biota and well-being. Psychologically, physically, sustenance, spiritually, for medicine discoveries, that half of the earth should be set aside. And then from that, a campaign was launched by a lot of different groups, including the center, to have 30% of the earth's surface in a protected status by the year 2030 and 50% by 2050, and that includes the oceans as well. California has signed on to this.
Yes.
And Governor Newsom has issued some funding for this, and California Wildlife Conservation Board is, assertively moving forward to assist this. But the idea is to have, and I'm not really sure the Stonegate project fits into that rubric or not, frankly, because it's unclear to me whether it will be. We know that the proposal that was advanced now violates the law and is ill advised. That much we know. Whether it is eventually acquired and made into a preserve, that's
right.
At this point, that's unknown to us, and it could be an outcome, but is not the purpose of the action.
Yeah, what we're hoping is that those of us who are working on this project, what we're hoping is that in the time that it's either the suit is underway or the referendum, we're still waiting for the county votes, the county to verify our votes for the referendum. But we're hoping that then we can find people who can buy the land and put it into preserve. So it's part of that California issue.
Right. Well, it's the idea is that the U.S. has an excellent protected land system, but it's really, when you add up all the acres, it really isn't that much of the land mass of the United States. It's something like 13%. You don't count national forests in that because national forests are, have multiple use mandate and a variety, but national parks you would count.
Okay.
State parks you would count. Marine preserves, you would count. There's a big battle underway right now where you've got the agencies, different agencies, including the Forest Service, saying, oh, well, you should count all the national forests as that because they're all, they're not going to be developed.
Right.
Which is true, and that's really good. But they're still not. Only certain sections of the national forest are protected, like wilderness areas, research natural areas, botanical areas. So there are areas of it that are protected, but not the whole thing. And so you can't count that against the 30%. Only those acres that are actually protected. And of course, you have these agency folks that are they're trying to What about the highway median strips? Those won't be developed. Like, well, but that can't count, because
oh my God.
That's really not.
Look
a
at that
habitat.
Cougar on that median strip. How's he doing?
Right. And so they're trying to sort of cast about to see what could be included, and that's becoming a big issue of you can't count this, you can't count this, and progress is being made. Like, for example, one of the things Biden can do, the president can do, is take public lands and turn them into national monuments, which have a greater level of protection under the Antiquities Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's something that the president can do, and President Obama and Clinton did with some pretty large acreages. There was the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument.
Yeah, that,
over.
Yeah.
2 million acres, and then they de-designated it, and then
Trump.
We sued, and Trump de-designated it,
yeah.
And then we sued, and then it got the court ruled that was illegal, and then Biden re-designated it, made it just a little slightly larger, just for future generations to remember, don't do that. So this is one of the things, and generally presidents do this near the end of their term, but there's a big push for this. The other thing that the president can do unilaterally is take public lands and create national wildlife refuges, which are another form of protected lands. And so California is, looks like it's on track to come close to its goal. Most of the other states are not at this point. But even California is going to need some substantial, really big acquisitions to make this happen. There have been some real big conservation acquisitions in the last couple of years in the state, and some that are in progress right now with partnerships of the state, the Wildlife Conservation Board, conservation groups that will count towards the 30. But our focus is largely on federal and some on state in different locations where there's receptivity. But that's the 30 by 30 campaign is a very important one. We have seven years left to accomplish this, and we feel that it is possible to do this, but it's going to require bold action from communities and politicians and the agency people. And so getting people to learn about this idea and realizing that it's a good idea. It's not some pie in the sky thing. It's actually a modest proposal. Even 50% of the earth in protected status is still allows for an enormous amount of economic activity. And so it should be compatible with continuing on with modern society and all that, but will provide an insurance policy for future generations and allow the biota and the natural systems of the earth to continue on. And it's important to remember that we all depend and rely on those. And at some point, if it's all fragmented into little pieces and too much of it is paved over or turned into rendered unsuitable for wildlife, it's not long after that it's going to be largely unsuitable for people too.
So we go ahead, Steve.
I was saying you're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Peter Galvin, the co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity. One of your priorities for the coming year is to defend and fully fund the Endangered Species Act. Please tell us about that, both defending and getting more funding.
Yeah. So the Endangered Species Act is the world's preeminent wildlife protection law. There's a number of countries around the world have adopted their own Endangered Species Acts, many of them modeled on the U.S. Endangered Species Act, or ESA. The Endangered Species Act is woefully underfunded, and it has been since its inception, and a variety of anti-environmental politicians have hamstrung this law from almost the beginning. And when they realized that they couldn't get rid of the law, that it was just enormously popular, it's one of the it's one of the most popular laws in the United States. It has a wide ranging support, ranging from 80% to 90% of the public and across all age groups and even political spectrums to one extent or another, that it they've realized that they could try and starve the agencies that implement it in the budget process in the hopes of limiting its ability to be effective. And so the amount of money, like just for example, the budget that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has, which is the main agency dealing with the terrestrial species, National Marine Fisheries is dealing with the ocean stuff, but the budget is about $25 million for the listing component.
Oh my gosh.
Where they look at species to decide should this species be listed, and they have a backlog. Like California Spotted Owl, one of the reasons it took so long is they were just the timber industry, went berserk and managed to succeed several times in stopping it. But two, the Fish and Wildlife Service kept saying, well, we just don't have the resources. This is a really complex thing. It's going to require a team of people for the analysis, and we just don't have the money. We're just going to have to put this thing on the back burner with a bunch of other stuff, and eventually we'll try to get to it. And meanwhile, there are a couple species that have actually gone extinct while waiting.
Yes.
In the waiting room to get on the endangered list. Fortunately, that's not the case here. But it's been a playbook in the right wing, the anti-environmental forces. If you can't get rid of it altogether, try and starve it to the point where it can't function.
Right.
And you see this in different facets and aspects. And so, there's been some studies done that show that about 150 million a year just for that. And that's not including the other things that are done under the Endangered Species Act. I'm now just talking about one line item.
Right.
For listing and critical habitat. If that budget was increased sixfold, that would be enough for the Fish and Wildlife Service to process the backlog that it's currently dealing with of several hundred species that are in the emergency room waiting room.
Right.
And they've been given a number and told, we'll get to you. When you look at that, well, $150 million, that's a lot of money, but I mean, if you look at just the cost of one of these, military aircraft, I think an F-16 costs about that much. Let's see.
Oh my gosh!
So no, it's really
the military budget
million.
Is
so, okay,
just
so
disgusting.
It would buy, I guess you'd need 2.5 F-16s.
Yeah.
But it's really a modest amount of money. It's a modest amount of money for what it does. It's a very efficient agency, a very efficient program. And so fully funding we've made some progress. The budget was half of what it is now just a few years ago.
Wow.
And so there's been a few congressional champions, including Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts and a couple other really good people who've worked on this issue year after year. And we have gotten it increased steadily. But it's still just a drop in the bucket of what is needed. So fully funding the Endangered Species Act is something that is, critically important, something that we've made some modest gains on, but really in order to actually deal with the level of the backlog and the crisis that there is, it has to be amped up considerably. And then the agency, in terms of protecting the Endangered Species Act, the Trump administration implemented a series of regulatory rollbacks that weakened different aspects of the Endangered Species Act. And the Biden administration, we've been working really hard, has just released rules that would re-strengthen the Endangered Species Act, but not completely. There are some rollbacks that they're not proposing to undo, which is totally unacceptable. Every single one of the rollbacks that were made need to be undone, unless there's some overarching reason why there shouldn't that we're unaware of. So there's some regulatory definitions and different ways in which, because they couldn't, even with all the houses of Congress, they still couldn't get the Endangered Species Act repealed or weakened legislatively, but they did it administratively. And that's the difference between Trump. That's the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Yeah,
the Republicans
get in,
and they just, they bring out the the knife and start slashing.
Right.
And the Democrats are hemming and hawing and, oh, well, we don't want to upset anybody and we've got to move slowly.
Yeah.
And then the time's up. And it goes back, and then they start slashing some more. And so it's we need people with fire in the belly.
It sounds
at the helm here.
Right. It sounds like you have made progress. We only have a couple minutes here, believe it or not, but it sounds like you all have made progress on protecting endangered species from pesticides, and that's been a huge issue, and it's a huge issue here in California. Is that involved legislation, or what all is involved? It seems to me that getting to farmers and demonstrating ways of farming that are superior, regenerative farming, would be a good idea. But what do you think?
Yeah, well, it would, and that hasn't been our focus. We're not. We're wildlife experts,
right.
Not agricultural experts, and there are, the organic movement is, a really important, really powerful movement, and the prices definitely command a premium, and so it can work out. But, you know, there's a lot of impediments to people doing that. You know, there's a lot of agricultural credit issues that kind of lock in these farmers where they're getting, you know, you agree to take the seed on credit, but it's going to be this Roundup Ready stuff.
Right.
So there's a whole series of these sort of agricultural policies that are really tilted to the pesticide industry. Like, you know, just
that's right.
an example, there's a law that registers pesticides, FIFRA. It actually in there, it's illegal for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to require people to tell them how much they sprayed and where they sprayed it. It's actually against the law. California has its own law. There's three states, California, New York, and I think Hawaii, have laws, a separate law that requires, in California, you can find out down to the square mile what pesticide was applied, when was it applied, how many pounds of it were applied.
Right.
That information is available, right? And so, but the big ag has a total stranglehold on the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Our focus has been litigation primarily, and research. Like, we did a paper in 2004 called Silent Spring Revisited, pesticide use and the endangered species.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a report in 2006 focusing on the Bay Area with endangered species. And we've done a lot of litigation. We've brought over 75 lawsuits to try and protect endangered species from pesticides. And we've been having some big successes in the last couple of years, and working closely with a group called Center for Food Safety, and have done a lot of stuff with we have a lawsuit going in California to try and get rid of these neonicotinoid pesticides. We're dealing with endocrine disruptor stuff. We have several attorneys who are just focusing on trying to get courts to undo the EPA's registration of individual pesticides. Now, what happens is the EPA relies on the pesticide industry for the science. So the EPA, it's not like they're in the lab testing this stuff out. They're just reviewing the pesticide industry's data and saying, you know, and the pesticide industry, of course, has a vested stake in jiggering things to make it look like the stuff isn't causing, you know, terrible problems.
Right.
The other thing they did was there was an incident database that was all, and this was a lot of farm worker stuff, but also animal kills, where for years the EPA maintained an incident database, which was either people that were poisoned, in many cases these were workers, or wildlife that was killed. They would be reported in a database, and we would look at that database, and that would be instructive as to, yeah, there's obviously something, you know, because the two groups that are bearing the brunt the worst are the farm workers and the wildlife.
We have to. Yeah. I have to stop you there because we literally have less than 2 minutes to finish up the show. But I do want you to tell people to go. Your website is terrific. So tell people where to go to find out more about the center and how they can contribute and how they can help you.
Yes. It's biologicaldiversity.org. www.biologicaldiversity.org, or just type in Center for Biological Diversity,
and it'll pop up
close to it, and you'll get there. And you can, there's a donate page, and there's also a sign up page for action alerts, and I encourage you to do both. It's really informative. It's not all gloom and doom. There's a lot of wonderful
and that good spirit.
Throw in a mix of beautiful, the beautiful, the terrible, and the inspiring.
And you've been very inspiring. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Peter Galvin. He's the co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity. He knows everything. And so go to the website. I can't recommend it too highly. And I can't recommend this organization too highly. So thank you so much. I really appreciate your joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Uh-huh.
Good night.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. And we're going to go almost instantly to Bobby Tryon's North State Voices, Chico Garden Club, and Horticultural Society with Susan Delgado and Grant Meyer. Anything else to say in 20 seconds?
No, nothing to say in 20 seconds except thanks for joining us tonight.
By the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Northern Star Mills, serving the North Valley with farm, garden, and pet supplies since 1898. Northern Star Mills offers natural and organic soil amendments,